Jack Dorsey is the inventor of Twitter and the co-founder of Square. Let's talk to him. Good to go?
We're rolling.
All right. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. My parents have always been big fans of the city. So St. Louis is interesting because it's really been in many respects destroyed by the 40s and 50s when everyone moved out to the suburbs and left a very desolate core. But my parents always stood by the city and always held roots there. And the city has since bounced back a little bit and is rebuilding. But I've always been fascinated by cities and urban life and never really been attracted too much by the suburbs or moving outside of like that urban core and all that urban activity. I love it. It gives me energy.
Did you go to school out there?
I went to you know, grade school, and I went to high school in St. Louis, and then I went to the University of Missouri Rolla, which was a engineering school, computer science, mathematics, and English were my majors. But then I found my true passion, and it was in New York in terms of what I wanted to do for work when I was around 18. And I moved out there, I transferred to NYU. I joined this company and then decided that I wanted to move out to San Francisco and start a company. So I dropped out a semester shy of graduating and have never gone back. And my parents still hate that decision to this day.
So did you, was that your first startup when you moved out to New York? Was that, so that was a startup that you were working for?
I was really attracted to dispatch. To couriers, taxis, 911 centers, mm-hmm. and I found the largest dispatch center and company in the world, and it had just gone public. It was in New York City, which I'd always want to live because can't imagine a busier, more bustling city. So I moved out there, and I became really good friends with the chairman and founder of that company. And this was in 99-2000, and you know the bubble was growing ever bigger here in the Valley. And we decided that we wanted to move to Silicon Valley and San Francisco in particular to start a more web-focused, internet-focused dispatch firm. So we did that. We started working on the code and started hiring some people. Unfortunately, made not the best choice in terms of CEO, in terms of like what we wanted to do vision-wise with what he wanted to do. We became very reactive to the bubble crashing, mm-hmm. and the company eventually failed. And my partner, Greg, bought it back from the investors, and there it sits. So that was my first startup.
So you were coding then?
Oh yeah. I've been coding since I was 14 years old.
So take me back for a second, back to 14. Did you launch any shareware apps? I mean, did you?
No, I was very selfish. I had a very specific goal with programming. I was really, you know, my favorite thing to do was to walk around the city, walk around downtown St. Louis, and wonder about bigger cities like New York and even San Francisco. And I just became obsessed with maps. I would have maps like hung all over my rooms, and I would bring like map books everywhere and in the car. And my parents thought I was like completely nuts and just like obsessive.
Was it the flow of human traffic? What was it that really got you excited about maps? Because most people don't think like, yeah, I'm really into maps. Like that's not a.
I know. It was just like if you look at a map and you just like look in an intersection, it's really easy to wonder what's happening in that intersection right now. And then like who's going to the intersection, who's going away, like how the intersection has changed over time, what's happened there in the past, what's going to happen there in the future. So it just really sparked my imagination and curiosity. And that traffic pattern is very interesting as well, and just like watching people go. So I got into programming because I wanted to play with maps more. The paper maps were really dead and I could only do so much with them. Besides like, you know, trek out and explore every street. But the computer allowed me to put a map on the screen, and I taught myself how to program so I could draw a map. And then I drew some dots on the map, and then I figured out how to make the dots move around within the street boundaries. And then I had this map with all these moving dots, but the dots had no meaning whatsoever. And the internet was just coming to be, so we had Gopher, we had all these like accessible databases. And WashU was in St. Louis, and it was a major backbone of the internet at that time. It had one of the first connections. And I found all these BBSs that had connections to WashU to allow me to get to the internet. And with that, and also CB radio, I heard emergency services, so I could see ambulances. And if you're thinking about an ambulance or a police car or a fire truck, they're always reporting where they are and what they're doing and where they're going. So those three inputs, I could say, here's where you are, here's where you're going, and here's what you're doing. So you could plot where they're going in the city, and then you could have a little indicator of what they're doing, like patient cardiac arrest going to St. John's Mercy. Mm. So suddenly I had meaning for my dots, and I could see what was happening in the city. In more or less real time, I had to put these things in and type them in as I heard them or as I got them from Gopher. But as it progressed, I got better and better about making it real time, and I found that this practice, this software, was actually called Dispatch, and there's a whole field around it. Mm-hmm. So suddenly I'm like, all right, I got to do Dispatch for the rest of my life and find the biggest dispatch firm in the world, and that happened to be in New York.
Yeah, well, and this also sounds like another startup that you created. Let's talk for a second. There's a lot of on paper, co-founders of Twitter, but you actually invented Twitter.
Yeah.
So tell me, where were you? What was that day like? When did that happen? Were you sitting in the office? I know you were doing Odeo at the time. Were you there one day saying, hey guys, I just got to try this idea? How did that happen?
Well, so I worked in dispatch for a long time. The majority of my career has been about real-time, low-latency, high-transaction systems around moving information. And it comes down to this very simple concept, which is someone broadcasts a message, and those interested in it follow it. And that's it. So ambulances constantly broadcast where they are and what they're doing, and dispatchers and call centers follow where those ambulances are. It's really, really simple.
Mm-hmm.
But
that was different than everything that was going on at the web at the time.
That
because
was
when
very
Twitter
different.
Launched, it was all about the mutual friendships and actual relationships. There was no really one-way following concept. So that's where the idea of following came from then.
Yeah. Yeah, we kind of got back to that core eventually, but we were kind of distracted by what was happening with social networks and being mutual. So in 2000, I was really interested in taking that concept and bringing it to my friends. And very simply, to allow me to be anywhere and just update what's going on and send that out to a bunch of people. And I wrote a very simple email script that took an email from a BlackBerry 850, which was the first BlackBerry, mm-hmm. and would broadcast out to a list of emails that I inputted. And I went out to Golden Gate Park, I went to the Bison Paddock and said, I'm at the Bison Paddock. It went out to all these people. And I quickly learned that no one else had BlackBerries and no one was interested that I was at the Bison Paddock. So 2000, it was just the wrong time. So I went back into dispatch, I went back into contracting, and Odeo was actually the first time I've ever written a resume and taken a real job. And I wanted to be more consumer facing. I wanted to learn more about consumer facing stuff. And went to work with Ev and work with Biz and Noah Glass. And the month after I joined, Odeo was a podcasting company, we were building a directory for podcasts. The month after I joined, iTunes launched its podcast directory. So it pretty much killed our entire path. So morale was kind of confused, and we didn't know what direction to go. And a few months later, in February, Ev was the CEO. He said, go out, come up with some ideas that we might want to work on. And at this time, SMS got really big in the country. Mm-hmm. And I just fell in love with the technology and its constraint of 160 characters, and talked to the three people I was talking to on the playground and said, what if we just do the simple thing of being able to be anywhere, use SMS, send it out, and it goes out to all these people in real time. Just let's do that. And we built a very quick system in a matter of hours, demoed it to the company, and it really didn't go anywhere. And then about a week later...
No name yet.
No name, okay. No name. A week later, we were also talking about more Odeo stuff, very interested in group communications, and again brought up this idea and said, let's just do this. And Ev thought about it a little bit more, Noah thought about it a little bit more. And then a week after that, we had a company meeting and said, we've decided that Jack's gonna go off, work on this thing for 2 weeks. And I left the room, started working on this project. We were calling it a bunch of different things at that time. and then took another programmer.
What were some of the other names?
Biz. We're calling it Jitter, Twitch, all really terrible names. We wanted it to evoke like a physical sensation though. Like when you get a message, your phone jitters, it twitches around, but Twitch doesn't like really bring up the best stuff.
Right.
Images. So Noah actually took the dictionary, went down the TWs, and found the word Twitter, and it means a short, inconsequential burst of information and chirps from birds. And this was in the new, you know, the new Oxford. And we're like, oh, that's perfect. So we'll take that name. But since we're based on the phone right now, and since the phone is a big part, then we need a short code. And short codes are 5 characters. So let's take out all the vowels, and then it could be TWTTR. So people can just type TWTTR to get into the phone to access this service. But then we found out that that short code was taken by team people,
wow.
Text team people. So we added the vowels back, and then it became Twitter.
Awesome. So you got the name. Did you have any idea at this point what impact the actual number of followers would have the people's egos? Because I noticed like very, very shortly, like, well, six months, a year later, all of a sudden, celebrities started using the service.
Yeah.
And it was kind of this thing where everyone looked at the more followers, the better. Did you have any idea that was going to be the case?
We didn't really consider it. We came up with the word follow and leave because we wanted it to be something again that spoke to a physical manifestation of something. So if you think of Twitter as like a whiteboard, you're writing all these messages on the wall,
mm-hmm.
and people can come up and they can look at that wall and they can stay and watch the wall as long as you want to write on it. And when they're disinterested, they can walk away, they can leave
mm-hmm.
from the wall. So it's very, very conceptually sound. So we're thinking more about like, just the verbs in it. And we took it a little bit too far one time when we like came up with this concept of worshiping. So if you worship someone, you would get every single one of their messages, no matter what they said, you know, all their at replies, everything. It was just like the full fire hose of everything they were saying. But we ditched that. So we took the following.
Worshiping, that's a little cultish. That's amazing.
Yeah. But that was some feedback on follow and leave was like, is it too cultish? Is it too stalkerish? But it's a really interesting term, and it really speaks to the action of like what people are doing. Like not so much unfollowing, but like you follow when you're interested and you leave when you're not. And that is really completely speaks to the complete recipient-controlled nature of the service.
Is it all or nothing, though? I mean, right now it is. You follow someone, you get every single message.
No.
Will it always be all or nothing, or do you think there's a place for saying, you know, I'm following my friend Daniel because he's a great graphic designer, and I only want the things that he's talking about that pertain to graphic design? I mean, will that ever exist?
I think it should. I mean, I think the challenge, not only for Twitter, but for the technology industry at large, is like building more relevant filters in real time, like mm-hmm. being able to surface valuable information immediately, no matter who it is, who's listening or who's broadcasting, is a really, really hard problem. And it makes Twitter a lot more meaningful. It makes Twitter a lot more approachable. But I think we've gotten really, really good at being able to put content in immediately, but getting it out in a relevant, valuable way in real time is still very difficult. So, mm-hmm. you know, that example, of course, like we should be doing stuff like that, but it's just like, it's a question of like the user experience and the, you know, the technology behind it, how much we put in algorithms, how much is human curation and like what the balances are.
So you're 2.5-3 years in and you have another idea. Was it 2.5 years in, something like that?
It was about 2.5 years in, yeah.
And Square comes along.
Yeah.
So tell me about Square. How did that come to be?
Well, that's the thing about, I think that's one of the strongest things you can cultivate as an entrepreneur is to not rely on luck, but cultivating an ability to recognize fortunate situations when they're occurring.
Mm-hmm.
Odeo was a very fortunate situation. Could have taken that idea, not told it to Ev, not told it to Biz, not told it to Noah and all my other coworkers at Odeo, and tried to start my own company with that idea. But the fortunate situation was that I was working with some really amazing people and we had a great team. So of course, you know, it makes sense to start there. The fortunate situation for Square was that in 2008, the end of 2008, the entire market was crashing down. Like all of these abstractions we built upon, abstraction upon abstraction upon abstraction in the financial world, which no single human understood, were now falling apart. And suddenly we were getting back to basics, back to fundamentals. Management teams were being asked to leave. Banks were failing. You know, people were clarifying around, like, we need to start getting innovative. We need to start treating our customers so poorly. We need to start, we need to stop, you know, encouraging bad behavior to reap fees. Mm-hmm. Like, we need to really turn this whole thing around. And anytime there's a recession or a depression, that's a great time to innovate, start a company, start a project, you know, do anything. So, you know, we recognize that time. And at the same time, my co-founder, Jim, recontacted me. I've known him since I was 15 years old. He was my boss when I was 15 years old. And he's like, Jack, I want to talk to you. I want to build an electronic car company. I'm like, that's interesting. And he was thinking about it because the car industry was failing as well. And like, he was like, why don't we just give these car companies to well-seasoned entrepreneurs? Like, why don't we give Ford to Steve Jobs? And like, you know,
that would be amazing.
It would be amazing. And like, you know, GM to Ellison or like whatnot. And he's like, and also I want to start an electronic car company. I'm like, you know, that's ambitious. But in that moment, we decided not to start an electronic car company, but we wanted to do something together. Mm-hmm. And we kept having these weekly conversations about what that thing was. And I was researching a lot with finance and healthcare because I was looking at, you know, doing something in those spaces. And Jim called me one day, one of us scheduled meetings, and he said, I just lost a glass sale. He's an artist, he sells glass. And I lost the sale because I couldn't accept a credit card. And here he was talking on his iPhone, his general purpose computer, and I was talking on my iPhone. And like, we couldn't figure out.
A 1 gigahertz computer sitting in the palm of your hand, but no way to accept credit cards.
Yeah, he couldn't accept $2,000 from someone who wanted to pay him.
Right.
Like, why is that? So we decided that we wanted to answer that question, and we did a bunch of research, and I started writing some server code, and we hired a guy to write some iPhone code, and Jim built some hardware, and in a month we had a big device that plugged into the audio jack of your iPhone and could swipe a card, take a payment, it would go through the merchant process and then generate a receipt with a map on it. And I went around, I showed it to a bunch of investors, and they were all amazed that it could even work. So we decided to really focus on it and make it a company. And it really just comes down to like recognizing that fortunate situation, recognizing the people around you that could help, and just owning it,
How do you think would-be entrepreneurs get over that hump? Because a lot of people say to me, they're like, oh, I've got this idea.
Yeah.
And it's always, you know, on paper or in their head, but they don't want to take that jump to actually start something. Like, how do you get over that?
Yeah,
like,
I've gone down that road so many times. I mean, the hardest thing about all this is to get started. And I think the most important thing that I've learned is that you have to, as soon as you have it, get it out of your head, get it on paper, and then to take it one step further, just show someone. Just show someone what it looks like on paper, even code a little bit, and show someone the interaction.
Like a working prototype, like just you and a buddy or something like that.
Exactly, and there's two outcomes, and they're both really good outcomes from that moment. Either you, like someone like really, it just sparks like a wow, like that's cool, or it says, you know, I don't know how to get into that. So you decide, I'm either gonna dedicate some more resources to this thing, or I'm gonna put it on the shelf for now, mm-hmm. for a later day. Mm-hmm. And that's perfectly admirable. Like, build a thousand things and then put them on the shelf. Like, you'll use them. Like that first idea for Twitter, put it on the shelf in 2000, reused it in 2006, and mm-hmm. now it's worked out. So I think you have to be comfortable with the fact that you're not going to go down every idea. You're gonna have some ideas that just the timing of the fortunate situation doesn't exist right now. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. So clear it out of your head, move onto the next idea, onto the next idea. But too many people just get stuck in this concept, and when it's stuck in your head or stuck just on paper, then you're always making excuses for why it doesn't exist. Like,
right.
If only I was working with Kevin Rose on this, or if only this situation happened in this macro environment, or if I was living in New York, or if I was funded by Fred Wilson, or like whatever.
Right.
You're gonna make 1,000 excuses and never do anything.
So talk to me about some of the challenges that you ran into, because hardware, I've heard, is extremely difficult to get into.
Yeah.
These being manufactured domestically, internationally, how did you go about actually building a physical piece of hardware?
I'm really proud of what we've done with Square in under a year. Like we're doing a lot at once, and a lot of the stuff we've never done before. So we're building hardware in China. We're fulfilling hardware through the United States Postal Service, which is a major challenge in itself to keep the cost down. We're building a payment network. We're building fraud and risk systems. We're building a web service. We're building a client. And then we're building customer service. Most companies do one or two of those things.
Right.
We have to do all of them, and we have to do them in a highly coordinated fashion. So everything we've done with Square, except for the bank, we've built from scratch. And we just have a lot of focus, and we just have this desire not to just build what's needed, but build what we think should exist. Mm-hmm. And that's the best thing about engineers and entrepreneurs, is that like a lot of people saw Square as just like this naive approach to the payments world. But that's a great thing. I mean, it's great for engineers to build what they want to see in the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, what else could you hope for than that? I mean, that's exciting. You don't want to build something that just like fits in to something else. So we've taken it as an opportunity to build what we want, build how we want the world to work. And, you know, we've been able to just like move very quickly along those goals.
Is it frustrating at times though, when you hit certain roadblocks? And like, how do you get around that? How do you keep everyone motivated? I mean, you've got a team of people now that are looking to you for motivation every single day.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you get up there and it's gotta be, I mean, I've seen, you gave me the latest prototype today, or this is the final version that you're shipping. Yeah. I've had three or four of these. I mean, there had to be some hurdles to get over. How do you keep everyone jazzed and excited about what you're doing?
I think the biggest thing is, one of my favorite things about San Francisco is the Golden Gate Bridge. You just think about, first, the audacity to even want to put a bridge over that span. The Golden Gate is very tumultuous. Like, all the weather is forced through that one gate.
It's constantly being maintained. Exactly. They can't take a day off.
Exactly. And like, it's extremely deep, and the waves are immense, and it's rocky, and it's crazy. Just to have the desire to do that in the first place is immense. And then to have the desire to make it beautiful at the same time is really, really telling. So you have this really interesting balance between, we're doing the impossible, we're going to make it beautiful, and it's going to stand up. So you've got this great, like, you've got this great pairing of vision and then architecture and then engineering, and it works. I mean, one major feature of that bridge is it stays up and it carries millions and millions of people. So we just go back to those basics. Like, we're running this company by design. We are building beautiful things. Payments has always been seen as a burden. It's always been seen that something you have to get through, and we have a rare opportunity to make it beautiful, to make it social, to make it something that people feel good about, so people can not worry about the burden of payment, but can actually enjoy the tea that comes after paying for mm-hmm. something. So we want to get people focused on what's important and not have to think about the utility aspect of paying people. And the interesting thing when you think about it is, more people pay for things than they use communications devices, than they use phones, or they use Facebook or Twitter or all these other things. Like, mm-hmm. more people in the world pay for things. It's just a cultural strength that we all go through every single day of our lives. And to have the opportunity to address that mass and to address that opportunity is immense. And once you speak in those terms, and yeah, everyone's excited. Roadblocks, opportunity. Let's pivot to something like we can use, and not in a negative way, but in a positive way. Here's a roadblock. Here's how we can shave it off and fix it.
Awesome. So two last questions for you. Give me one thing that you would never do again in any startup that you start, and then one thing that you would absolutely take with you no matter where you go and use it again and again and again. Like, just a tool for success. Like, what is one thing that you've learned?
I think the biggest thing for me, I think for all startups, is that it's really, really easy to consider any hire as like the length of the entire company. I think leaders of companies have to consider themselves editors. and you constantly have to edit the team. You constantly have to make sure that you have the best people in, and if there's any negative attribute within the team, person or element or otherwise, you have to part ways.
And because, deal with it right away.
Yeah, right away. I mean, you have to say, like, this is the best thing for the company, and to be fair to both of us, like, it's just not the right time for both of us. Like any other relationship, you need to be able to recognize what's good and what isn't optimal and take action on it. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that, you know, I would, like with Twitter, like we grew very, very slowly and we didn't edit the team in the best way. We didn't get out of the way of ourselves often enough. So that's something I would never do again. But what I would do, and what I would encourage every entrepreneur and anyone starting a project to do, is really focus on the data, really focus on the analytics, really focus on how people are using the system and collecting that. And this goes like, you know, we have a dashboard in Square and we have a metric. How many times do people actually look at that dashboard to see how the company is doing? Mm-hmm. Because that speaks to like how much people care about how the company is.
So this isn't Google Analytics. I mean, you're talking about build a home brew.
Build your own system.
Custom to you and means something to you.
You have to tailor it to yourself. And mm-hmm. and this is starting companies, starting art projects, starting films, whatever. You need to have an understanding of the momentum of what you're doing, and then where you're going. And you can only do that with data.
And that informs a lot of your decisions and product decisions, things
exactly.
like that.
And communication, and also like hiring and editing the team.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Jack, see you soon.
See you.
That's it for this episode of Foundation. Foundation is always free and it's always ad-free. But if you want to get access a week early before it's released to the general public, sign up for the private newsletter at the URL below. Thanks.